Hey everyone, this is Adriana, producer of The Skill Set. I just wanted to let you know that a new episode of The Skill Set is live, and you can listen anywhere you download your podcast. This new episode is with Solomon Renfro, a talented sneaker designer at New Balance, who shares his unique journey from studying interior architecture to becoming a footwear visionary. You don't want to miss this conversation.
On last week's episode, I asked for some opinions on whether or not a college degree should be required to be eligible to take the NCIDQ test for licensure in the practice of interior design. I received a great bit of feedback, some of which I shared with a good friend and a well-respected voice in the interior design's advocacy community, designer and professor John Otis. So, in this episode, I read three letters from different listeners that John and I discuss. Two of these letters present clear and well-articulated opinions, and the last one, that explores bigger questions around the profession of design as a whole. I'm excited to hear what you think about this third letter and the questions proposed by former IIDA International President and Design Principal at Jacobs, James Kerrigan. But before you jump into this episode, some more news from around the network. Our host of the Design Pop, Alexander Sefos, has put together a virtual design summit called Pop Into Excellence. The event runs from May 14th through the 23rd, and Alexandra has curated an excellent array of speakers. You'll hear from our own Aaron Esterbrook on how to grow your personal brand. Other topics will include developing a bulletproof team, discovering your strengths, and many more. The event kicks off with a star-studded panel. I don't want to give away who that is yet, but there's some great names ahead. The link to join the waitlist will be in the show notes. And stay tuned for future episodes where we'll drop some promo codes that could save you some dinero. All right. Lastly, before I move you into my conversation with John, on the same episode where I asked this question about NCIDQ eligibility, I also made reference to the now newly launched episode on the skill set where host Cheryl Durst chats with New Balance shoe designer Solomon Renfro. What a fun name. Well, in the last week, that episode has just taken off. It's had a ton of listeners, and for good reason. It's seriously entertaining. It has kind of stoked a new relationship between me and my clothes. When it comes to clothes or accessories, you've heard this line before. Well, I just can't pull that off. Right? Well, Solomon's take on that expression might give you the courage to step into a fresh new look. It's just great to have a show where we can gather perspectives across the big, broad design landscape. All right, here we go. Let's get you started on my conversation with John. John, as you know, I have some juicy feedback. Several messages rolled in. I'm going to share two of these up front. I'd love your reaction. I'd love your guiding thoughts on this subject. This one's from Weston Treffs. Hi, Doug. I really enjoyed this episode. Regarding your first question, I firmly believe there should be a pathway to NCIDQ licensure, even without a college degree. As a recent graduate myself, I found that school helped me grasp the language of design, but my growth as a designer has truly accelerated since graduation. It's often said, and I wholeheartedly agree, that exceptional design ideas will always shine through, regardless of the creator. Denying creatives the opportunity to be licensed in their field of interest simply because they lack a college degree would be a disservice to the industry and an ever-increasing financial burden. All right. Interesting take from Weston. This one is from Amanda in Dallas. Hi, Doug. I just listened to your podcast about the NCIDQ. I would like to add some passionate feedback as one who has a bachelor in interior design and attempted the NCIDQ for years. I understand the notation that one doesn't want to exclude anyone, but in the topic of professional certification exams, I think a bachelor's degree / 60 hours of certification should definitely be required. The education needed should not be excluded. The work it takes to obtain a degree or diploma in interior design is not an easy feat. I personally spent lots of time, money, hard work, and hours of my time to become an interior designer. It was the biggest disappointment to not pass the exam and a hard choice to move forward without licensure. I don't think it's fair to allow those who did not put in the dedication and hours into education. Professional exams are extremely difficult and should require the time it takes to get a degree. If someone without a design degree was told they could just take the NCIDQ, it would make me think, why did the rest of us spend our time getting educated? I think there should be more credit to those who did take the NCIDQ and did not pass. Just taking the exam is a really big deal. If NCIDQ were to open the licensure to those without a design degree, then I think they would need to change the format of the exam and perhaps the cost, similarly to how LEED has different versions based on experience. Two very differing points of view, two very justified points of view. That's why I'm a bit stuck on this, John.
It's challenging and it's difficult to think about it. Especially, you know, I'm an educator. I spend a lot of time talking about design, interior design, and trying to inspire my students through the creative process. But let's say this, that, school, you know, education has a lot of theory, right? It's a lot about thinking. It's teaching young people how to think, right? And not necessarily how to execute things to build them and for practice. There is certainly some of that. There are courses related directly to that. But much of what we do is about the creative process and inspiring them that way. And that's not necessarily the only way to be creative, right? Education is, you know, getting a degree is one way. There are other ways. I spend a lot of time in books. You know, I spend a lot of time going to museums and galleries, attending performances. All of those ways are incredible ways to be inspired and to learn to be creative, you know, and that's not necessarily going to school. I've known in my career some people who have not gone to school and who are draftspeople, let's say, in our industry, who were incredibly adept at what they did. And we as designers couldn't exist without them, but they weren't educated in design. This is particularly in Europe where I was working for a while. And they knew much more than I did about the process of drawing and getting something to a place where it could be made. Maybe they weren't as inspired through, you know, having not had the education that I had, but they were certainly adept. You know, I'm on the advocacy council for the IIDA. We're talking about the NCIDQ and certification. And we're also talking about this other idea, and that is, should programs in colleges and universities be called interior design or interior architecture? And that's a whole other polemical discussion.
Strong
beliefs about that. But anyway.
Well, that's a great segue into another bit of feedback that I think is going to spark a larger conversation. All right. This one's from James Kerrigan in Dallas. Hey, Doug. I've been reflecting on the question you posed on the last podcast about alternative pathways to professional qualifications in our industry. You're right to question whether apprenticeships or other non-traditional routes can offer a viable alternative to conventional pathways. In reality, the prospect of embracing alternative qualification routes raises its own potential challenges. Is there a meaningful enough difference between these paths, or should we consider a more fundamental shift in how we qualify professionals? For example, in our country, the burden of debt from a traditional education path is substantial. Does this traditional path inherently provide more value than an apprenticeship could? Does this create more value for practitioners? What do we need to learn and where? Would we accept a surgeon or a lawyer who gained their skills through apprenticeship? If you had to choose between a schooled or an apprenticeship, which would you choose? Would our bias kick in? Would one be less attractive than another? The essence here is not the path itself, but ensuring that all professionals, regardless of their learning journey, meet a rigorously maintained standard of competence. Perhaps an evolved path that delivers equity in experience, one that evolves to reflect how knowledge is acquired, and to reflect a change in landscape of where and how we learn. What is the end game, and what is it for in thinking about the design industry? More accessible and more inclusive is a good thing, I remain interested in where and what we are delivering. What is the value? We are often compensated for lines on paper, but I think our value lies beyond the line. Is it lines on paper, or is it knowing where to put the lines on paper and knowing sometimes when no lines are needed at all? Your point about redefining educational and experiential paths in our industry is well taken. It's about articulating the value of what we do beyond simple metrics like cost per square foot. If we only measure our worth through these reductive metrics, we will miss the full scope of our expertise. What competencies should our educational frameworks highlight to prepare individuals for our industry? Should the emphasis be solely on technical abilities, like mastering specific software? Or should we prioritize nurturing creativity, creative thinking, communication? Additionally, how does the proliferation of learning through platforms like YouTube affect our profession and the skills required? Lastly, is the term interior design too narrow and limiting? Perhaps it's time for a rebrand that more accurately captures our value proposition. Cheers, James Kerrigan. Now, I wish I could read that in his awesome Australian accent. John, there are a lot of questions in this message. It's hard to know where to start.
It is. It is. And I have tremendous respect for James. We're friends. And I'm, I'm right in line with what he said. I couldn't have said it better than he has in this letter. There are certain things that an education provides, let's face it, that you might not get by just putting in the time in some firm, right? It has a value. It's more inclusive. It provides perhaps a worldview of things. And that's that maybe you don't quite get if you're just moving in from, you know, and getting an experience directly. And it may not work the same way. And like he talks about lines on paper, et cetera, and what is the value of what we do. And part of that value, I think, comes from an education. Now, in terms of that final part of interior design, we're exploring that. And I personally have very strong feelings, having been part of various, teaching in different schools, most of which call themselves interior design. I've struggled with the idea of what interior design means and being an interior designer and the value of that. And NCIDQ obviously is part of that, right? Acknowledging our expertise, that is separate expertise or a different expertise than what architects do. And we cannot call ourselves architects. Even if we graduated from an interior architecture program, we are not architects, and therefore we cannot be licensed as architects and cannot call ourselves architects, just like we couldn't call ourselves a lawyer unless we had a law degree and passed, right? Or a doctor, same thing. So I feel strongly that we are interior designers. That is a valuable thing to be. What we offer and what is different than what architects offer. That middle ground of interior architecture is interesting. Do I think I, as a practitioner, I believe that I can do interior architecture, but it doesn't mean I'm an architect. It just means that I can move walls and do the kinds of things that architects would typically do on the interior, which we consider architecture, versus selecting furniture, selecting materials, selecting, which is more in the purview of interior design, right? I can also state unequivocally that that there is a great difference, since I teach mostly with architects who teach interior design, right? They are teaching interior design, but they have been educated as architects and their experience has been as architects, and they don't have the same understanding and knowledge of interior design that interior designers do.
So they couldn't call themselves interior designers.
They might, but the reality is that what we teach in interior design, generally speaking, it bridges that. It does bridge that. Yes, it's interior. It's interior architecture on a certain level, absolutely. But it's interior design too, and you can't call something interior architecture, because then you're tossing out the window, to me, I think, a valuable part of what we do. The knowledge of furniture, of what furniture is appropriate, of textiles, of materials, and all of those things that we as human beings come in contact with arguably is more important, because most of the spaces that we occupy, we cannot change, right? You don't necessarily move into an apartment and say, I'm going to move all the walls around. You live with it. But we design it on a certain level. We can change it, and it makes it feel good for us. It becomes our home without moving a wall. So I don't know. It's a big question. I feel strongly about interior design as being valid, you know, and important.
I listen to you speak, and I'm reading James's question. Is the term interior design too narrow and limiting? And my feeling is that it's not. And it's not the term itself that's limiting or narrow. It's the perception of the term that is narrow or limiting.
Agree.
The term is the right term.
I agree.
And it's hard to actually think of a better one that's more all-encompassing. But at the same time, you know, like the perception doesn't capture the psychology mm-hmm. that's involved. It doesn't capture the science, and it doesn't capture the value, because the perception is that it's not essential, you know? It's almost like the profession needs a PR firm.
Well, that's IIDA, I hope.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, they are beating the drum tirelessly. Based on what I've feel in the past decade, I feel like it's gotten better. I feel like the perception of interior design continues to be more valuable.
I agree with you. And, you know, it's interesting. It's funny, but James threw in the, you know, about a doctor or a lawyer, et cetera. And I thought, well, that's kind of, it's not really an apples, you know, someone's life is at stake. It's necessarily, maybe a building would fall down, but I don't know.
Yeah.
but it's interesting that I think, two points. One, being in school, being at a college or a university, and I said this idea of a worldview and an inclusive idea. We are in a place with a lot of people from different countries, different cultures, and that informs our thinking as well, right? It should. And I think more so, more than ever now, if we get away from the sort of Eurocentric approach to design and thinking, and we become more inclusive, you know, in that way. And it's a good thing. So I think we provide that. Education provides that, where in a workplace environment, depending on where you live, it's going to be different, right?
Right.
So universities, colleges generally provide, you know, a more open platform for thought and experience and opinion. And I think that's important. And in the end, you can make your own decision in which path you take or which direction you want to go in. But at least you've had the opportunity to be exposed, right, to different ways of thinking and about design, in this case, specifically about design. But I love this discussion. Doug, we all have a panel or something. And
I know. There's like, I feel like there are so many angles mm-hmm. to think that you and I could explore all those nooks and crannies would be a miss. You know, there's like so many ways to think about it. Even just when you mentioned that question, I was thinking about it. I'm like, I don't know. I don't know which one I'd be comfortable with if I had to pick a lawyer and one that was, you know, that learned through apprenticeship, and one that maybe has less experience but has that degree. Mm-hmm. I don't know which one I'd pick.
Sure.
I can legitimately say I would be torn there.
You know, that's interesting too, because there's specificity of it, right? It's like as a professional in those two fields, right? There's so much specificity, like what doctor do you go to for whatever thing? There used to be more generalization, and now it's like, you know, that's funny, true. Because I think design is that way. I learned for a long time, I wanted to call myself a designer, and I'm a designer, because I didn't want to categorize it. Yes, maybe I had some education. My education was primarily in interior design, but my experience went beyond that. I designed computers. I designed objects. I designed television sets. I designed, you know, in a variety of interiors that go across the board, from workplace to healthcare to showrooms to residences. I'm a designer, and I look at it very inclusively in that way as well, right? And not that, but everyone, you know, particularly in this country, want to say, so but what kind of design do you do?
Right,
are you a fashion designer? Are you a, you know, and I'm like, well, I don't know. Maybe I could be. But the reality is, because I look at the world as an opportunity for design, right? And
yes,
and that's to me. I say that to my students. You know, you're getting educated as interior design, but you might want to do textile design, and you might want to do furniture design, and you can do all of that. Maybe it can be all encompassing if you open yourself to that possibility, and you want to learn, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me, it's like, I can picture, that airplane moment. Is there a doctor on the airplane? And it's like, I could see him, people standing. Well, what kind of doctor?
No, I can't help you because I'm a plastic surgeon.
Yeah, exactly.
But afterwards, is what I could do.
Is there a designer? You think that question would ever come up? Is there a designer on the airplane?
Right.
Well, what kind?
No, it's and so I don't know. I think it is a great discussion to have, and we are, on the one hand, this NCIDQ thing, and that was interesting too, about that, like having taken it, not passed it. It is challenging. It is difficult. But does that mean if somebody's been out working, didn't go to college, maybe went to a vocational school, went and started, learned how to do all of the computer stuff, everything you need, the skill sets, went out and spent 6 or 7 years working in a firm, and then was able to take that exam and pass it because they didn't go to college? Does that mean they didn't deserve to be how do you view that one? That's a really tough one, right?
Here's a question. Do you think there is any risk of progress in advocacy that could be lost through accepting licensure without a degree?
I think that's a great question. And I think that there's a good point there. I think so. Because the same thing that would be true, I mentioned to you in my comment that led to our discussion, was that, Frank Lloyd Wright and Mies van der Rohe never went to architecture school. And what architects can argue with that? No one can argue about it, right? Arguably the two most famous in Western canon of architecture, right? Most admired, perhaps, on so many different levels. I take students every year to see their work in Chicago and et cetera. It was a different time, granted, but still. But now things have changed, obviously, in terms of architecture and how regulated it is now. And some of that for good reason, because you're dealing with dangerous objects,
systems.
However, and the funny thing about that is, in the end, engineers will deal with a lot of that stuff anyway. Architects don't have to, right? We get a specialist.
Yep.
But there you are. There's evidence that it's possible. So, I don't know, Doug. It's a great discussion, I think, to have. And I think this is a start of something. I believe that you have started something here, and it's good. It's a good thing.
That's good. Well, thank you, John. I appreciate it. And it was great to have you on. Great to get your thoughts on this. I can tell it's been something that's on your mind too.
Yes.
And then, the dialogue is still going. It's still open. I think there's yet a lot to be discussed.
Doug, thank you. It's great. It's always a pleasure. I really enjoy speaking with you. And I love your podcast. It's great. Always learning. I'm always learning from it.